Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. We're dedicating today's show to remembering the Titanic's doomed voyage in the North Atlantic 100 years ago this week, a disaster that still resonates unlike any other shipwreck. There are some details we all know. The ship didn't have enough lifeboats to save its passengers, and the lifeboats it did have were half full when lowered away. The so-called unsinkable ship was nonetheless unwise to race through an ice field it had been warned to avoid, and precious few souls on board realized the grave status of the Titanic until the ship was already lost. But what makes Daniel Allen Butler's best-selling Unsinkable, the full story of the RMS Titanic, so engaging in its new edition, which is published by DeCapo, is the tense blow-by-blow recounting that raises new questions and reveals startling details in tracing the Titanic all the way from the shipyard to the ocean floor. Butler is a respected historian who's written extensively on the Titanic and other maritime subjects. He's written a new foreword and postscript for this edition of Unsinkable, which was first published in 1998, and he joins us now. Daniel Allen Butler, welcome to the Roundtable.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is new and what's known that wasn't known when this book first came out?
There are a lot of details that have been discovered since 1998. Nothing tremendously startling in broad strokes, but we've learned a lot more about the specific lives and the experiences of passengers and crew that were on the Titanic. One of the big things is that in the wake of what I call Titanic mania in 1998, people who had some sort of family connection with the Titanic, whether it was in Belfast or Southampton or here in the United States, the descendants of survivors, et cetera, went back into their family records and into their attics and trunks and scrapbooks and found letters and diaries, et cetera, so that a lot of the personal information has become available over the years.
From a historian's point of view, is there a deficit in finding out some of that information because so many of the survivors seemed unwilling to discuss exactly what happened that night until maybe old age or not at all?
It really is disappointing in a way because I noticed that in the case of some survivors who were willing to discuss their experiences, their stories changed over the years. And I don't mean to denigrate or demean any of them, but there were at times they would contradict themselves 30 years after their initial statements. One lady who was a 7-year-old girl when she sailed on the Titanic, Eva Hart, originally was adamant that the ship went down intact in one piece. And then when the ship was discovered in 1985 and found to have broken in two, Eva then suddenly adamant is saying that, well, I always said I saw that ship break up before she sank. So, yes, I am disappointed that there has been a dearth of recollections. But what's happening now, especially in the case of these letters and diaries and such, many of them have been written very close to the events. So the recollections are very vivid, and survivors didn't have the opportunity to remember with advantages, as Shakespeare would have put it. They were recalling firsthand memories that were fresh.
Why do you think it is that this story is so trenchant in our minds and, you know, in our national culture? It's bigger than just a shipwreck. It seems to represent different things to different people. And here we are 100 years later. There have been any number of disasters since then, even one last year. But what is it that makes this so current?
Well, first off, Ian, understand, if the Titanic sinks, that's a disaster. If the Titanic sinks and takes 1,502 lives with her, that's a tragedy. And there's the distinction. There have been any number of events that can be called disasters because of the scale of the damage done. But it's the tragedy of the Titanic that still holds us. The thing is in the story of the Titanic, you will find any person who approaches it with an open mind will discover in the Titanic story that there is someone, a passenger, a crewman, someone working in the shipyard. There's someone in that story that will have a resonance for them. And then when that happens, you begin to understand that this was a situation where very ordinary people, basically good, decent people, were thrust into an extraordinary circumstance. It's people like Engineer Harvey who rushed into a wall of rising seawater in a doomed effort to save his friend Jonathan Shepard down in boiler room number 5 when one of the bulkheads collapsed. It was Jack Phillips who had already spent 18 hours at his wireless key that day. He was still tapping out a distress signal when the Titanic's power failed 3 minutes before she sank. It was Second Officer Lightoller who kept the men on collapsible B alive throughout the night so that when the Carpathia got there, they were still alive. They hadn't frozen to death. It was 18-year-old Daniel Marvin who saw his 18-year-old wife of 3 weeks into a lifeboat and then simply stepped back on the deck. It was the crewman whose name we don't know to this day who handed his lifebelt to Minnie Coots, one of the passengers, and said simply, "Remember me." These are people that we can suddenly establish an understanding of and, if you will, a link with. These are people who, as I said, were ordinary people in an extraordinary situation, and they simply refused to go gentle into that good night. They were like Tennyson's Ulysses. They would strive to seek, to find, and not to yield.
What a poignant part of the book when that one crewman says, "Remember me," and only later does the passenger realize she never got his name to begin with. There's two ships that could have gotten there close enough to make a difference, and the Carpathia did everything in its power to get to the Titanic. It went on overload and chugged along the sea and kind of turned off all the reserve sources to get there in time. The California, depending on who you believe, and the case seems pretty airtight, so to speak, that the California could have done a lot more and recognized the rockets going up and decided, you know, never to go. Is a ship obligated, or at that time, was a ship obligated to make the effort that the Carpathia did, or was that in itself sort of a superhuman effort?
This is one of the reasons why I love history, because it presents opportunities like this that fiction can never match. You had a situation where you had two captains, Arthur Rostron on the Carpathia and Stanley Lord on the Californian. One of them did everything right, the other did everything wrong. And Arthur Rostron literally drove his ship at high speed through an ice field, desperately trying to get to the Titanic in time. It wasn't his fault that his ship was too far away to get there before the Titanic sank. In the case of Stanley Lord, what you had was a situation where his officers were watching an unidentified ship to the south firing rockets. They reported seeing rockets to Captain Lord. He acknowledged he understood that they were seeing rockets, and he chose to do nothing. Now, the reason I keep emphasizing the word rockets, it's very important to understand that the British Board of Trade regulations, and the British Board of Trade was responsible for the safety regulations of British shipping, the British Board of Trade regulations at the time when it was listing what should be regarded as signals of distress included, and I'm quoting now, "rockets or shells of any color or description being thrown up at regular intervals should be regarded as a signal of distress," end quote. So this was clearly a case where these rockets were being sent up at regular intervals. If they weren't precisely 5 minutes, it was close enough. And crew on the Titanic had more important things to do than stand around with a stopwatch, making sure that the intervals between the rockets were precise. But it's more importantly than just the debate over whether or not the Californian saw the Titanic's rockets is this. The officers of the Californian saw somebody firing rockets that night, and firing rockets in a manner that indicated that the ship firing them was in distress. Now, the word distress at sea has one meaning and one meaning only. Somebody, somewhere, is about to die. So there was someone out there, whether it was the Titanic or a fishing trawler or the Spanish Armada, it doesn't matter. There was somebody out there firing white rockets who was desperately fighting for their lives. And Stanley Lord, who was an incredibly self-centered and self-obsessed man, simply could not be bothered to go to their aid. He had stopped for the night at the edge of the ice field, and if someone else ran their shiny new ship up onto an iceberg and needed help, well, that wasn't his problem. He had done the right thing. He had done the prudent thing. He had stopped with someone else's foolishness and let them pay the consequences.
Now, while that drama is playing out, there's something happening between the passengers as they're slowly realizing just what's at stake here. It took a while for that to happen and for that to catch on. Talk about, if you will, the Edwardian code of ethics or whatever it was that made these people so gentle in the face of such overwhelming misery and odds.
The whole Edwardian ethos and attitudes of Edwardian society worked against the passengers and crew in many ways that night aboard the Titanic. And in other ways, it highlighted what were the strengths of Edwardian society. Now, one of the weaknesses was the fact that the Edwardians had an almost mystical faith in technology. And they truly believed that the Titanic was unsinkable. People refused to get into the lifeboats initially because there was no sense of immediate danger. You mentioned that a lot of the lifeboats left the ship only half filled. This is because people were flat out refusing to get into the boats. The majority of men in first class who survived were able to get into lifeboats simply because the women would not get into the boats without a man or two in the boat with them. Wives would not leave their husbands. And First Officer Murdoch, who had responsibility for the starboard side boats, had a policy of letting women in as long as there were women who were willing to get in, and then he would let married couples in, and then if there was still room, he would let single men in. But for probably the first hour, people really didn't think that the ship was in mortal danger. It wasn't until she took on a noticeable downtrim by the bow that people began to realize that this was a serious situation. So the faith of the Edwardians in technology essentially blinded them early on to the danger. Now, on the other hand, there was a very real sense within the upper and middle classes that there was an obligation on the part of the men to conduct themselves by a certain standard. It was considered to be more noble to die than to save yourself and be regarded afterwards as a coward because you'd done so. A lot of fuss is made over the fact that a third of the men in first class survived, and I've just explained why so many of them actually did. But when you say that, oh, it's a shame that it's shameful that a third of the men in first class survived, well, the flip side of that is that two-thirds of them died. You're talking men like John Jacob Astor, one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest man in the world at the time, Ben Guggenheim, who multimillionaire, heir to an immense smelting industry and metallurgical industry, Charles Hayes, the president of the Grand Trunk Railroad, John Thayer, who had been the vice president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, Isidore Strauss, who was one of the founders of Macy's and one of the most respected businessmen in America. You know, these were men who, to a man, refused to get into lifeboats. They understood that the price of living well was that they might be called upon to die well as well. It was like Macbeth said of the Thane of Cawdor, nothing in their lives became them so much as the leaving of them. In second class, it was even more severe. 90% of the men in second class died on the Titanic because they understood that their responsibility, as they understood it, was to stay out of the lifeboats, to leave room for the women and children. That was what, in 1912, that was what was expected of a man. You didn't have situations like you had on the Costa Concordia, these idiots in flip-flops and Bermuda shorts running around, dude, where's my lifeboat? Instead you had men standing aside going, you know, darling, get into the lifeboat, I'll see you in the morning, and stepping back on deck knowing that they had no chance of survival. And that even extended to the crew, something that gets overlooked in all of the brouhaha over what class suffered the most casualties and why, is the fact that 80% of the crew went down with the ship. Now, we've got plenty of examples over the years of crewmen on sinking ships forcing their way into lifeboats ahead of the passengers. In fact, to bring up the Costa Concordia again, Captain Schettino got off in one of the first life rafts to leave the ship rather than staying on board his command and supervising the evacuation from there. The crew understood their responsibility as crewmen was to the passengers, and that, again, by staying out of the lifeboats, it made room for the passengers. And if the passengers didn't get into the boats, it wasn't the crew's fault.
We know that the Titanic is highly unlikely to be brought up from the bottom of the seafloor, as was sort of the thinking some years ago. We know that eventually it will disintegrate on the seafloor and be left there. As we're looking back on the Titanic this week, it's the 100th anniversary, and that's put some renewed interest on the story. But do you think we'll still be talking about this 20, 30, 50, 100 years from now? Is there something about this story that makes it seem current for us, or is this maybe the end of the Titanic mania?
Ian, I don't think that it's the end of Titanic mania per se. I really can't say that I believe that it will ever reach the sort of peak that it's attaining right now. There's always a sort of cachet that attaches to the 100th anniversary of any major event. But at the same time, because the Titanic, both name and thing, are a microcosm of the world that she existed in, and this is something that is I cannot emphasize more strongly, that people should understand the Edwardian world gave birth to our world. The 21st century is a product of the first decade of the 20th century. The roots of our world are very, very firmly set in the Edwardian world. And that gives that Edwardian world a resonance. And because the Titanic is a microcosm of that world, it will always have a resonance to people who want to understand the world that they're living in today. You see, you can never really know where you're headed in the future unless you understand how you got where you are today in the first place.
The name of the book is Unsinkable, the full story of the RMS Titanic, out now in a new edition published by DeCapo. We've been speaking with historian Daniel Allen Butler, and it's been a pleasure to have you on the roundtable today. You are an expert on this ship, and I appreciate you taking the time to contribute to our special show.
It's been a pleasure to be here, Ian. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.